Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 19 in our series on the Book of Acts. And today we will be wrapping up the first missionary journey of Paul. So the title of the lesson is The First Missionary Journey, Part 2. And we will be in Acts chapter 14, and we will cover all 28 verses of the chapter. So, now, let's review briefly where we're at. The first missionary journey took place somewhere between the years of 44 and 46, and it began in Antioch, which is up in the Roman province of Syria, north of Israel. And Paul and Barnabas set sail. They went to the island of Cyprus, and then up into modern-day Turkey. They kind of went up, and they are now kind of in the heart of it. When we left them off, they were actually in the town of Iconium. So I don't think we have just a whole bunch on there to cover as far as history goes. I believe that we dealt with that last time. Now, once again, I'm going to recommend that you look at the map in the back of your Bible or look one up on the internet. If you just Google, you know, Paul's missionary journey map, you'll find a map of this, because it's very hard to describe this because this is a region we're not very familiar with. So describing the placement of these towns gets a little bit tricky. So, now let's go ahead and also set up some of the stuff that's important to remember. Is that once they did land, that they ended up at a place called Antioch, not the same Antioch. It's called Antioch in Pisidia, or Pisidian Antioch. And there they ran into a little bit of trouble with the Jews. There was a great response to Paul's preaching. There were many, many Gentiles who responded, and the Jewish leaders got jealous and upset, and had them thrown out of town, had Paul and Barnabas thrown out of town. And from there, they headed to this town of Iconium. Now, Iconium today is probably going to be best known for being the hometown of Luke, the author of the Book of Acts. Now, that there's some conjecturing involved in that. We're not entirely sure, but it is here that we will see Luke began to write "we" instead of "they" and stuff like that. So there's a lot of evidence that points to this. We're not exactly sure. There's many legends and stuff that perhaps, you know, Luke and Paul were actually childhood friends. I've heard some stuff like that. I think that's more work of fiction than fact. But nonetheless, this traditionally this is the hometown of Luke, and we're going to see Paul and Barnabas are there, and I tell you what, we'll just jump right on in and get started going through this chapter. So, Acts chapter 14, verse 1. And it came to pass in Iconium that they went both together, that's Paul and Barnabas, into the synagogue of the Jews, and so spake, and a great multitude, both of the Jews and also of the Greeks, believed. So, they preach. There's a great response. And now the Jews and Greeks. Now, of course, it's kind of confusing. But you have to keep in your mind when it talks about Greeks. There, we're talking about Hellenized Jews. It's not talking about Gentiles. Why would Gentiles be at the synagogue? Why would they be listening? So you've kind of got to use a little logic there in that. But we're talking just simply about Jews and Jewish proselytes. So just people there inside the synagogue, it seems like, have been saved. So, because notice in verse 2, it doesn't use the word Greeks, it uses the words Gentiles. So you've got to keep that in mind. Verse 2, but the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles, that's the Roman general populace of the people, and made their minds evil affected among the brethren, or against the brethren, sorry. So, once again, here we go. This is the general pattern. Paul shows up in town, Paul preaches, people are saved, opposition arises, and Paul leaves town. That's basically kind of what happens with some variation throughout Paul's missionary journeys. So they have now stirred up trouble. So there's opposition. They're not quite as welcome or don't have the luxury of obscurity because they have spread these rumors about Paul and Barnabas. So verse 3, long time therefore abode they speaking boldly in the Lord, which gave testimony unto the word of his grace and granted signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So we see the nature of their ministry there. They're actually there for a long time. How long, we don't know. Perhaps up to a year, but we're not really sure. But it is a lengthier portion of time that Luke's going to record that. And of course, they're preaching the gospel, and then God is blessing their ministry. He's allowing them to work signs and wonders to prove their ministry, to show God's power in their lives. That's the purpose of the miracles. So able to do that, and which I say the superstitious Romans and say superstitious people of Rome in general, or you know, just people in general at the time, this is something that would really catch their eye because they were always looking for stuff like that. They were very superstitious, always looking for omens, and they even regarded Jews a lot of times as having some type of soothsaying ability. So, you know, if a Jew's able to do that, they were seen as some kind of prophet or at least like a fortune teller, maybe something a little more mystical than we would be comfortable with. But that's basically the way that the Jews were seen. So verse 4. But the multitude of the city was divided, in part held with the Jews, in part with the apostles. Verse 5, and when there was an assault made both of the Gentiles and also of the Jews with their rulers, to use them despitefully and to stone them. So, we'll leave it kind of mid-sense. So, we see that there is a division. Because of the work of Paul and Barnabas, there are a group of people that are for them. There are a group of people that are against them. And this is spilling over. They're actually ready to stone them. So they're basically going to let the Jews stone them. This is not something that the people of the place would have practiced or Rome would have approved of. Had this been Rome, they would have been beaten or whipped or beheaded or something. But the stoning pretty much shows this was a Jewish thing, that the Jews were ready to pass them off as blasphemers and heretics and punish them according to the Jewish law, and that they had the approval of the Roman leaders to actually do that. So verse 6, they were aware of it and fled unto Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and unto the region that lieth round about it. Verse 7, and there they preached the gospel. So they leave Iconium and they head to Derbe and Lystra. Now Derbe and Lystra, let's say, with a lot of this on the first missionary journey, I'm not giving just a whole lot of history. And in the case of Derbe and Lystra, it's because we don't necessarily know a whole bunch about it from what I've read. These are on the trade routes. In fact, Lystra, I read specifically, it was actually on the old Persian Royal Road that the Persian Empire had built up there into that region. So Derbe, we know about that it was on a trade route, but very little is known about it. They haven't done a lot of excavation and stuff, but it was just a kind of a regional town there. Lystra, pretty much the same way. We know it's on the Persian Pearl Road. The Persian Royal Road. We know that it was a market town, that there was a large market, perhaps mostly because of the trade. So people could buy goods that were passing through or sell their goods to the traders coming through. It's about 60 miles away from Derbe, so there is some distance between these. But these two towns, somewhere in this region, Paul is visiting. He's perhaps visiting both of them, the towns in between. And they're preaching the gospel. Now, Lycaonia is the region name. That's not the name of a town. It's actually the region there in Asia Minor. So there we go. Now, at Lystra, we're going to see that they're going to run into a little bit of trouble again. So verse 8, and there sat a certain man at Lystra, impotent in his feet, being a cripple from his mother's womb, who never had walked. Verse 9, the same heard Paul speak, who steadfastly beholding him, and perceiving that he had faith to be healed. Verse 10, said with a loud voice, "Stand upright on thy feet." And he leaped and walked. Boy, my reading's off today. So while they're at Lystra, which I say this is a fairly large town, moderately large sized town. There's a market. It's on the trade route. So, but while they're there, there is this man who is a cripple. He's never been able to walk, and Paul miraculously heals him. Well, of course, this is going to bring a crowd. This is going to bring some attention on the work of Paul and Barnabas. And in this case, it's going to be a case of mistaken identity. Verse 11. And when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Lycaonia, "The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men." So immediately they perceive that these are the Greek or Roman gods. Now you remember, outside of the Jews, practically everyone else in the Roman Empire were polytheists. And, you know, they basically all accepted that they worshiped the same gods, or, you know, you were allowed to worship your own little local deities, or, you know, have an emphasis on a certain god, or just have a regional practice that was totally different. But basically, they made room for all of the gods. They merged, you know, the Roman gods trace back to the Greek gods, who trace back to, you know, even further back. And if you read the book, the Two Babylons, which is supposed to trace the Roman Catholic Church all the way back to, like, Babylon. But if you read that book, for example, it's the only book I've seen that really does this, it traces the religion, and you can actually see from Rome to Greece back to Babylon that a lot of these gods and these ideas are the same. That, you know, the Greek Aphrodite and the Roman Venus are the same as, you know, Ashtaroth or Ishtar or some of these other pagan deities from the Middle East. And they just would transfer these stories and, change a little bit regionally or culturally. But essentially, they were the same gods. But nonetheless, these polytheists that they were, when something miraculous happens, like, oh, wow, these guys must be gods or sent from the gods. And does it matter which god? No, not really. But everything miraculous happened to be attributed to a god. And it didn't matter which one. So they missed the point of the miracle is to show that these men had something special that trumped all the pagan gods, the pagan false gods. And showed that the true God had empowered these men to preach his message. But these pagans instead saw it as, wow, the gods have sent us these messengers. Verse 12, and they called Barnabas Jupiter and Paul Mercurius because he was the chief speaker. Okay, so it's very interesting here, and this may show some of the influence, but Barnabas, they attribute him to Jupiter. Jupiter, that's the Roman name for the Greek god Zeus. He is basically the king of the gods and, the ruler of Mount Olympus. And so basically he's seen as the leader. Paul is Mercury. Mercury is kind of a lesser god, very, very mobile, also spokesman. So that basically shows that perhaps Barnabas, because of influence or stature, seems to be the leader, though Paul is the one that's actually doing a lot of the speaking and the work. But, people are still looking at Barnabas as perhaps the elder figure or the leader. So verse 13, then the priest of Jupiter, which was before their city. So in this town, there actually is a temple to Jupiter. You know, there may not in a town, especially a provincial town, not a major capital. There is not going to be temples to all the dozens and hundreds of gods, but there's probably one or two or three or four that are they're worshipped locally. And at this town, it appears there was a temple to Jupiter, to Zeus. And so the priest is in charge of that, says, which was before the city, brought oxen and garlands unto the gates and would have done sacrifice with the people. So this fits right in with how they would do this. This is one of their deals, is they would get oxen for a sacrifice, which was a big deal. In some cases, this may be the only meat that people would eat in the entire year. So, I mean, when they got together to do this big barbecue, it really was a very, very big deal. So they get them together. They would get these oxen to sacrifice. They would adorn them with garland, with flowers and stuff in place on their heads, and then go leading them through town. And if I remember correctly, if the oxen would balk at it, if they weren't willing to do it, they would basically find another oxen and start over, because everything had to be just so when you did this kind of stuff. But nonetheless, I mean, this is about to become an official festival. They're about to kill the fatted calf. They're about to have a big barbecue and worship Paul and Barnabas. So let's see here. Where was I at? Verse 14. Which when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of, they rent their clothes and ran in among the people, crying, verse 15, and saying, "Sirs, why do you these things? We also are men of like passions with you, and preach unto you that ye should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein." Verse 16, "Who in times past suffered all nations to walk in their own ways." Verse 17, "Nevertheless, he left not himself without witness, and that he did good, and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness." Verse 18, "And with these things scarce restrained the people, and they that they had not done sacrifice unto them." So, excuse me. So in the midst of this, this pagan ritual, this pagan celebration that goes on, Paul and Silas, they rent their clothes, they rip their clothes, which is, it's a sign of mourning, a sign of being upset. And yeah, so you've got to be pretty upset to rip up your clothes, but they seem to have done that a lot in those days. So they rent their clothes, they rush in among these people to try to stop this celebration, because these people are trying to worship them as gods. And now let's say, this kind of stuff would happen quite a bit with false prophets in different places. People would pop up, supposedly perform a miracle, and people would worship them. Perhaps this is where some of this, these sorcerers we read about in the book of Acts, perhaps were this type of con artists. And we see here the high character and of Paul and Barnabas, that they would not fall for this, that they would not accept this from themselves, but they stayed to task and stayed true to the word of God. So they protest, they rip their clothes, they run in among them and basically preach sermons, say, "Hey, look, hey guys, we're men just like you. We're here to tell you about a bigger God than your little false gods," and tries to get their attention. And verse 18 basically says that they just barely stopped this, that the people were worked up and mob rule had kind of taken over, I guess, but the people were so worked up, ready to sacrifice and probably excited because, they were about to have a big barbecue, that they barely got them calmed down. They didn't really convince them of anything, but they did at least barely stop the proceedings and stop this, this sacrifice and celebration and stop, maybe at least stop the worshiping, but it doesn't sound like they really changed any minds or hearts in the process, but they at least stopped what was going on. So verse 19, "And there came thither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium," remember that's where Paul's already been and been run out of town, "who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead." So about this time, you imagine everybody's still worked up, wondering what in the world these people are about, and there's already been this big commotion. And so then messengers from the Jews, that were from Antioch and Iconium, perhaps they had heard about what was going on at Lystra, but they actually show up, and based on their testimony, and they are able to work up a crowd against Paul and Barnabas. So, which is strange, because it seems like Paul's been there, that Paul has had some success, but nonetheless, they work up a crowd of people, and they stone Paul. And it talks about that they drew him out of the city, which this is, what you do, if they would stone somebody, they take them outside of the scene, basically just leave their body, and you know they weren't worthy of being dealt with. I mean, it's just like leaving trash. And so, you know, it was just up to somebody just to get the body and bury it if they would even bother. So they stone Paul, which of course this shows this was Jewish. This was not a Gentile, method of execution or even punishment, but the Jews get him, they stone him, and they leave him outside the city, assuming he's dead. Now, I'll go ahead and verse 20, we'll go and read this. "Howbeit, as the disciples stood round about him, he rose up and came into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe." So, let me go ahead and interject here that there are many, many Bible scholars that do believe that Paul was actually dead, and that Paul did die, because Paul speaks later of perhaps seeing the third heaven. He says he didn't. I can't remember the reference for that. I can't believe that right now. But talks about being caught up into the third heaven, and he says, I don't know if it's a dream or what, but there are Bible scholars who believe that this is where that took place, and that Paul perhaps actually died, actually went to heaven, and but was sent back to earth because, his mission wasn't complete. Now, it's so hard. Did that really happen? Well, it doesn't seem to be, but it does seem that he was beaten almost to death in the least. That this was a pretty violent and cruel punishment that he had undertaken. Now, did he actually die? Did he actually go to heaven and come back? I don't know. I'm not sure you can prove it, but there are many people who will point out that this is where that happened. So just to throw that out there, I'm not going to say it did or didn't happen. I'm really not sure. But if it was going to happen somewhere in what's recorded in the book of Acts, this is the most logical place for that to happen. So, all right. So verse 20, which I've already read, let's look at that. That as the disciples, that they gather around, they're mourning the loss of Paul, and he gets up. And so I imagine everybody there thinks he's probably dead too. And Paul just gets up, and they go back into the city. And the next day they get out of Dodge, and they head back to Derbe. So we see, that it's with that violent of a punishment given to Paul, it probably was a good time to get out of town, which they quickly did. So verse 21, so now that they're back in Derbe, says verse 21, "And when they had preached the gospel in that city and had taught many, they returned again to Lystra and to Iconium and Antioch." Okay, so they go to Derbe, they preach the gospel, and now they're going to start making their return back to Antioch. And in doing so, they're just going to basically revisit the places that they've already been. So, of course, they just left Lystra, so they go back to Lystra. They return to Iconium. They've already been there. They go back to Antioch, which is, say, Antioch in Pisidia. So, what were they doing while they were doing this? Verse 22, "Confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith, that they must, through much tribulation, enter the kingdom of God." Verse 23, "And when they had ordained them elders in every church and had prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believe." So basically what they're doing is making sure that the churches are set up, that the people understand what's going on, and basically trying to leave them in good shape as they work their way back to Antioch. So it talks about them confirming and exhorting. So they're working to explain the doctrines and give these guys a good basis and encouraging them to go on, explaining that the road is not always going to be easy. I like how that's thrown in there, that talks about through much tribulation, that they throw that in. It's like, look, just because we've had some hardships, that's not unusual, and it's going to happen. We're going to have hardships. So verse 23, it talks about ordaining elders. So that's, setting up church leadership and pastors in every church. Notice, you know, there's another case where it's singular church, that it's not a plural or a universal church, that's every congregation, perhaps in just singularly in every city, speaking of the believers there as a church, but that in every case, in every church, they were establishing this leadership. So they go back around and they set the church in order. They work with the believers, you know, teach them a little more doctrine, teach them a little more practice, and they depart, move to the next scene, continue this practice as they're working way back to Antioch. So verse 24, and after they had passed throughout Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. So Pisidia is the region there. It's in Galatia. That's where Antioch is, that we've been talking about. Pamphylia is the region right along the coast. So they've worked their way out of the central area there in Asia Minor. They've worked their way back down south to the coast. Verse 25, and when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. Perga is the capital of Pamphylia. So I believe we've already talked about that. Attalia, I don't believe we talked about last time, but it is a port city there, so that's where they're going to go to hitch a ride back to Antioch. So verse 26, and thence sailed to Antioch, from whence they had been recommended to the grace of God for the work which they fulfilled. So they've returned and completed their circuit, completed their journey, back to where it all started, and it says that they had fulfilled that mission that God had ordained them to do. So that this was what God had done. They had finished the work that God had planned for them. They had carried the gospel into Asia Minor and reached multitudes of people who had not yet heard the gospel. And they have set up churches in these places. So that they have done a tremendous amount of good on this journey. Verse 27, and when they were come, and they gathered the church together, this is in Antioch, they rehearsed all that God had done with them, and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. Verse 28, and there they abode long time with the disciples. So they come back to Antioch, you know, there's a big meeting, everybody's excited to hear the report, Paul and Barnabas get up, and they talk about what had happened. They talk about the people that are being saved. They tell them about the miracles that had taken place. They tell them about the lives that are changed. They tell them about the places they visited and the churches they've set up, and they report all this up. But most importantly, really about the only detail that's recorded here in what they give is that the Gentiles had also received the gospel. So, which, okay, you know, say this still kind of carries in. We've had a general theme taking place ever since Peter had preached to Cornelius, and Cornelius was the first Gentile to be saved. We've dealt with that. In fact, it took us a couple of lessons to get through that story. We saw the controversy that took place after that. Was that, let's see here, was that chapter number 11? Chapter number 12 doesn't really fit in, but then chapter 13, we begin chapter 13 and 14 have the missionary journeys of Paul. There a lot, at least four of the last five chapters have dealt with the gospel reaching new places and reaching into the Gentile people. The first Gentile was saved actually there in Israel in Caesarea. But now there are Gentiles being saved in Gentile regions up in Asia Minor. So the gospel is not only open to new people and also into new areas. Is that going to cause controversy? Yes, it is. Now that everyone has already come to terms that, you know, Gentiles can be saved because they have been saved with Cornelius. So that's already been established. This was nothing new. When Paul and Barnabas went out, it's nothing new for a Gentile to be saved. That has been taking place. But there's still going to be a controversy arise around this. And that is, you know, how are these Gentiles supposed to worship? Most of the Christians at this time were Jews. And as Jews, they still practiced much of the Jewish religion, if not all of it. And they just kind of added Christianity to it. I mean, they just saw the deeper meaning in the sacrifices. But they would still, it seems like, attend synagogues. Paul felt very comfortable going to synagogues on his journeys. Now, did he, when he was in Antioch back at home? I don't know. I find that kind of doubtful. But, but they were still very comfortable. They were still very much Jewish. They still practiced, the Mosaic law. So what were these Gentiles supposed to do that were being saved? Were they supposed to become Jews also, and worship as the same manner as a Jew, as a Jewish Christian was at the time? Or, because they weren't Jew, were they free from observing the law? This question is going to come up. And in our next chapter, it's going to become such a problem. They're basically going to have to call a council together, get everyone together and say, fellas, we have to decide this right now and get settled what the church is going to believe and what the church is going to practice on this. Because, did Jesus come to destroy the law? No, he came to fulfill the law. But did that do away with the law and the practices and the observing of the holy days and stuff? What were you supposed to do with all those commandments? Well, we'll get into that in the next lesson. I've kind of rambled quite a bit to set up the next lesson, but we're going to deal with that in the next lesson. But where are we at though? We have finished up and we've wrapped up the first missionary journey of Paul. Now, of all his journeys, the three missionary journeys and the journey to Rome, this is the shortest, as far as miles traveled. And basically, they've stayed fairly close to Antioch. As they continue out, every journey is going to take them just a little bit further and a little bit further. The second missionary journey, in fact, they actually set out basically just to visit these same places, but God leads them into Greece. So, but anyway, first missionary journey is finished. As a small, it's a bold step, but in light of the subsequent journeys, it's a pretty small step in as far as miles traveled, as people reached and the impact made. Most of the towns he's visited are very unimportant. In fact, if it were not for the book of Acts, most of these would probably be lost to history, or, resided to some obscure references in history books and, a local museum and a local archaeologist. That's going to change, though. Paul's going to visit bigger places. He's going to reach more people. I am rambling. I'm going to wrap this up. I appreciate you listening. If you enjoyed it, you can check out everything else at BaptistBasics.org, the other lessons from the series on the Book of Acts. You can email me, podcast@BaptistBasics.org. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you.